Tuesday morning to you, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon Podcast. Since it is Tuesday, this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode several years ago. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on December 16th of 2012, under the headline, Jim Turk, Shanghaier, Swindler, Drunkard, Millionaire. The Shanghai artists of the old Portland and Astoria scene were all a fairly secretive lot, but none of them were more mysterious in quite so many ways as the man who started the whole Shanghaiing scene in Oregon, a burly, hard-fisted bar fighter named Jim Turk. Jim Turk was a slumlord who lived in his own slum, a drunken brawler who got hauled into court for a battery dozens of times, an abusive husband, a Shanghaier of sailors, a whorehouse operator, and a dishonest clothing salesman. Oh, and he was also the equivalent, in $1880, of a millionaire. Here's Jim's story, or what we know of it anyway. Jim Turk was born in England in 1832. And the Oregonian reported upon his death that he was a, quote, man of family. However, he was by the age of 16 in America and fighting in the Mexican-American War, which is a very odd thing for a man of family to be doing, a bit like a successful lawyer's son joining the French Foreign Legion today. By 1866, Turk had gotten married to a statuesque beauty named Catherine, who was at least his equal as a boozer and a brawler, and the two of them had opened a boarding house in San Francisco. They had two children, both sons, named Charles and Frank. Then, a few years later, the Turk family suddenly quit San Francisco and moved to Oregon. Jim apparently ran a saloon in Pendleton for a while, then moved to Portland and opened Oregon's first ever sailor's boarding house there. This was an odd thing to do, because Portland at that time was almost exclusively a regional port. It shipped plenty of wheat and other supplies out all right, but most of it was bound for San Francisco on coastwise freighters, not across the deep blue to Shanghai or Hong Kong. Coastwise sailors didn't typically use sailors' boarding houses. Well, whether he was running from something or just making shrewd business decisions, the move paid off handsomely for Turk. As deep water traffic in the port increased, so did his boarding house business, and he soon expanded it into a sort of one-stop shop for sailors, selling oilskins and pea coats and other mariners' apparel, too. At the time, the sailors' boarding house business, also called the crimping business, was one of the most disreputable occupations in society, and with good reason. It was basically a forced indebtedness scam. Here's how it worked. You rented the cheapest building you could find, close to the waterfront. You stocked it with crude beds and invited single men to stay there on credit. You marketed it chiefly to sailors, but laid-off loggers and naive farmers were welcome, too. Hobos could avoid getting nicked for vagrancy by checking into your place, so you'd get some of them as well. No money changed hands. It was all on credit. Then would come a day when one of the ships in the harbor would need sailors, and the men in your boarding house, who by now owed you more money than they could pay, would be required to discharge that debt by signing onto that ship. You'd present your bill for room and board to the captain of the ship, who'd pay you and deduct it from the sailor's wages, and he'd also slip you a bonus, a finder's fee of sorts, which was commonly called blood money. Of course, you had to be a number one fighter to make this work, because nobody ever wanted to go to sea. They'd run you down and skip on the bill if you let them. That's why so many boarding house operators were active or retired prize fighters. To keep the boarding house full, you'd go out to meet the incoming ships, climbing aboard them even before they'd reached the dock, passing bottles around, inviting the sailors to desert the ship and come stay at your place. This practice was initially welcomed by the skippers because then they wouldn't have to pay the men their wages if they deserted, although by the 1890s that was no longer the case. On those occasions when a ship needed a crew and your boarding house was empty, you'd go out drinking, meet a new friend at the bar, dope his drink. He'd wake up the next morning on a ship with his name forged on the ship's articles and often with a U.S. Marshal standing guard to make sure he didn't jump overboard and swim to shore before the ship got out to sea. This, of course, was what we now know as Shanghaiing. Well, Jim Turk and his sons did all these things, although they'd never admit to the Shanghaiing. They ran some other scams as well. At least on two occasions, they sold sailors suits of marine clothing and then secretly stole them back before the ship sailed. The customer was left having paid for clothing he didn't get and no way to fix the issue short of diving overboard and becoming a deserter, which, actually, one guy did. All these tricks were standard procedure in San Francisco's colorful Barbary Coast waterfront in the 1860s. Turk simply brought them to Portland and ran the system here, like a McDonald's franchise. As the 1870s wore on, Turk became a familiar figure in the city courthouse. He loved to drink, and he loved to fight, and he was hauled up on battery charges literally dozens of times. Each time he paid his fines and posted his bail in cash, Turk never seemed to have any trouble with money. Then in 1877, an odd little item appeared in the Portland Morning Oregonian. Went a little like this. Quote, "A gentleman from San Francisco, by the name of T.J. Zingson, now stopping at the Norton House, informs us that he came expressly to bring the astonishing news to Mr. James Turk of the Portland Sailor Boarding House that he has inherited about 20,000 or 30,000 pounds, which was left to him some years ago without his knowledge," the paper remarked. Turk, sure enough, started suddenly making large purchases. He started by scoring a palatial one-stop sin center called the Grand Central Variety Saloon, which appears to have been one of the earliest of the much-maligned variety theaters of Portland. These theaters played low-rent vaudeville shows, after which the actresses would come out and vamp the customers to induce them to buy overpriced drinks. And, as historian Barney Blaylock points out, the fact that the Grand Central had 17 rooms in it strongly suggests that it was also a bordello. Turk also bought some land and a restaurant in Astoria that may or may not have been more than just a restaurant. But his lifestyle didn't change, and neither did his business practices. There are rumors about Turk, as there are about the other Shanghai men. One claims he shanghaied one of his own sons after the lad started getting into card games and loose women and ready drink. Given Turk's own predilections for all these things except maybe the women, this seems rather unlikely. Even more unlikely is the rumor that one of his shanghaiing victims turned out to be a physician who came back to Portland singing Turk's praises because the long sea voyage and clean salt air had cured his tuberculosis. Anyone with even a passing familiarity with the life of an 1880s sailor, especially the cramped, unsanitary forecastles in which they slept, will have a really hard time buying this one. Going to sea was how you got tuberculosis, not how you got rid of it. But in 1890, Catherine died. Jim remarried a little later, but his heart wasn't in the crimping trade anymore, and increasingly, he left that to his sons. He died 5 years later on in Tacoma at the age of 63. The Morning Oregonian apparently felt some pressure to say something nice about this freshly dead thug, but this apparently was no easy task. They came up with this, quote, "While he possessed a rough exterior, he had a great many friends among his own class," the obituary writer managed. "He was generous and would do a friend a good turn when an appeal to his better nature was made." Today, 120 years later, you can almost hear that newsman's teeth grinding as he bangs out those grudging praises. The generosity comment addresses the real mystery of Jim Turk. Where did his money come from? Even before his inheritance, if that's really what it was, he always seemed to have plenty of it. Was he perhaps a remittance man, a son of a wealthy family who, having embarrassed his family beyond redemption by some act, was sent into exile with a monthly cash payment contingent on his never returning to the family home? Perhaps. But he was fighting in the Mexican-American War when he was 16, which means he would have had to have commit his great sin at the age of 13 or 14 years, and this seems awfully unlikely. Then, too, there's the suspicious vagueness of Mr. Zingson's story told to the Oregonian. Zingson clearly sought out the Oregonian reporter and told him about this inheritance, which seems like an odd thing to do. Then in doing so, he names the amount of the inheritance as 20,000 or 30,000 pounds, a strange way for a guy who knows the exact figure to phrase it. It also seems bizarre that Turk didn't change his lifestyle in any meaningful way after inheriting this money. He went on brawling and swindling and shanghaiing and stealing just like before. I mean, a man needs his hobbies, I guess. Finally, though, I haven't found any reference at all yet that tells whom exactly Jim Turk inherited that money from. So is it possible that Jim Turk's money came from somewhere else? Perhaps it was the fruit of some epic swindle perpetrated overseas. Maybe it was the proceeds of a decades-long blackmail scheme that finally ended with a lump sum payment. Or maybe he'd robbed a payroll train. Who knows? All we can really say is that the pieces don't all add up. And we can also say with absolute confidence that without Jim Turk, Portland would have been a far less colorful place. Key sources in this story included works by Barney Blaylock, Richard Dillon, and the archives of the Portland Morning Oregonian and the Daily Historian. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. More info is at our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulp Lit Productions, a boutique publishing house about which more can be learned at pulp-lit.com. Speaking of which, if you enjoy listening to me, you might check out some of my audiobooks. You can find them most easily with a search for my name on audible.com. Most of them are old pulp stuff, H.P. Lovecraft, Edgar Rice Burroughs, etc., but at least two of them are Offbeat Oregon history type stuff. Check them out if you're so inclined. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode? Email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.